They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I am constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Hello, this is William Hilt. Thank you for listening to the Necessary and Proper podcast. On May 6th, the Article 1 Initiative was pleased to partner with the Jacksonville Lawyers Chapter to host Congressman John Rutherford of Florida's 4th Congressional District to share his wide-ranging thoughts and reflections on the current state of the legislative branch, whether Congress is living up to the founders' original vision, and how his chamber can overcome the current partisan climate to better serve their constituents. We hope you enjoy the Congressman's address.
It's really good to be here with so many good friends. Hey, Jay. And as I look out and see so many friends, I have to tell you, I am truly blessed. I had a tremendous calling in law enforcement. It was never a job for me. And in fact, I used to tell folks I've never worked a day in my life. It's always been a calling. And now I'm fortunate. After I was term limited out as sheriff and had to leave the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office and what was a great calling, I thought, well, I'm just going to retire, enjoy my retirement, enjoy my grandchildren. I dusted off my old surfboard and my tennis racket, and I was playing a lot of tennis and surfing. And then Omar Mateen killed 49 Floridians down there at the Pulse nightclub. And I knew from my previous position that was a failed immigration policy and a failed national intelligence policy. Wasn't long after that, if you remember, there was a group marching down the streets of New York chanting something that I never imagined in my life I would hear in America. What do we want? Dead cops. When do we want it? Now. Couldn't believe it. And then, wasn't long after that, they got their wish. In Dallas, Texas, 5 dead police officers assassinated in one night, 9 others wounded. Sitting there that night, I told my wife, I said, I got to get back in the fight. I said, I cannot sit out and just enjoy my life with this stuff going on in the country. I got to get involved in the fight. And she's like, well, what are you going to do? I said, I don't have a clue. Didn't have a clue. But you know, the Lord shuts one door and then he opens another. And literally within a few weeks of that conversation, Andrew Crenshaw, my predecessor in D.C., decided to retire after 16 great years in D.C. And I thought, thank you, Lord, that's how I can get back involved in the fight. And a lot of people don't know this about my career, but when I was sheriff for 12 years, I was also legislative chair for the Florida Sheriff's Association for 9 of those 12 years. And it's kind of funny the way that happened. When I first became elected sheriff, I wanted to move the mentally ill out of my jail and back into community treatment. So I draft this bill. It's going to save lives. It's going to save money. This is a great bill. And I go to the Florida Sheriff's Association legislative meeting, and I present my bill, and they're like, John, great bill, but we don't have room on the agenda. You know, you can only run so many bills, and I understand that. I said, but look, guys, I got a great bill. Let me run it. I'm sure I can get it passed. The bill failed. See, I was so naive. I thought bills passed on their merit, you know. So what I realized as I came back to Jacksonville and thought about what had just happened in that session, I realized I had lots of coalitions and relationships here in Jacksonville, but I didn't have them in Tallahassee. So I spent the next year in Tallahassee, making those relationships, building those relationships on both sides of the aisle. The very next year, I take that same bill. I go to the FSA legislative meeting, want to get my bill on the agenda, and they're like, sorry, you know, I'm still the new guy. I'm like, okay, well, I didn't get sideways with you last year. Can I run it again on my own? And they said, yeah, go ahead. This time, the bill flew through. Flew through. At the end of the session, the executive director comes to me and he says, hey, John, the legislative committee just elected you chairman for next year. I said, okay, I'll do that. I had no idea I'd be doing it for 9 years. So I had a little experience with that sausage making from a different side of the desk, but I've been involved in it. So when this opportunity came up, I thought, this is great. You know, this is how I can get back involved. And I have to tell you, I went to D.C., and I knew that there would be some frustration. But before I talk to you about immigration, I want to talk to you about what I think has created some of this problem. I've never seen an organization where the rules get in the way of doing the right thing so many times, and where ideologues on both sides have taken over. And I will tell you, one of the rules that I think needs to be changed is that 60-vote cloture rule in the Senate. Folks, it's killing us. And I'm going to give you just a brief history. In 2017, we passed out of the House, under our Article I responsibility, a budget that had a $300 billion cut in all 12 appropriation bills to fund that budget. First time it had been done, and it was done before the end of September. First time that had been done in 13 years. All 12 of those appropriation bills go to the Senate, and they sat there through three continuing resolutions until spring of 18. And finally, Senator McConnell rolls them all up into one big omnibus, if you remember. But because of the 60-vote cloture rule, he still has to get, at that time, he still needed 8 minority members to vote with him to get that 60-vote cloture rule. So you can beat a filibuster, which they don't really filibuster anymore even. But they have this rule, if you can get 60 votes, then we can't filibuster because you can break a filibuster with 60 votes. So all they do is whip the bill. If they don't get 60 votes, they don't bring it to the floor. Nobody filibusters anymore in the Senate. Anybody seen a filibuster in the last 20 years? No. Because all they do is take this whip count, and that's it. So basically, the majority has turned over their majority to the minority. 8 minority members now run the Senate. So here's what happened. McConnell takes that omnibus bill and he has to go shopping and buy 8 Democrat minority votes. 8. It wound up costing this country $1.2 trillion. A $300 billion cut becomes a $1.2 trillion deficit because of that 60-vote cloture rule. The health care bill that we were unable to pass. 60-vote cloture rule in the Senate, they knew they could never, if we passed our health care bill in one big piece, they knew they could not pass it through the Senate with 60 votes because it's become so partisan. It's always a straight party line vote. So to get around the 60-vote cloture rule, one way to do that is you take the budgetary piece of ACA and you do budget reconciliation, which by the rules only takes 51 votes. So what did we do in the House, the Republican House members? We took our bill, ripped it into three pieces. The budgetary reconciliation piece, the regulatory piece, because the HHS secretary has like 1,400 times in ACA. It says he will, shall, may, can, 1,400 different levers that he can pull, and that's a big deal. And then third and finally was the piece that was going to deal with medical savings accounts, sale of insurance across state lines, healthcare partnerships, and all of these things that were really going to save a lot of money. But the reconciliation piece was the first piece to go because it only took 51 votes. Well, the problem was the CBO, they score every bill. Well, when they scored that reconciliation bill, the story was horrible. You all heard it. 23 million people are going to lose their insurance and yada, yada. It was a horrible story. But I'm back home trying to tell everybody, but wait, that's not the bill. That's just phase one. We got phase two and phase three coming. And I can tell you, people's eyes just glazed over. We never got to phase two and phase three with anybody. There was never any understanding. So the bill died in the Senate with Senator McCain's last stab at the president was voting no on the health care bill, and it failed. Without that 60-vote cloture rule, we could have rolled that bill up into one. And if I could go back, I went along with that strategy, but if I could go back, I would force the leadership, Paul Ryan at that time, to pass that bill as one bill in its totality. So that when the CBO scores it, the story is completely different. But that's what the 60-vote cloture rule did to us in the House. And in the end, it actually wound up costing several members in the House their seat during the midterm elections. So, folks, this 60-vote cloture rule is killing this country. Another thing that's killing this country is a very partisan position in Washington, D.C., on both sides of the aisle, led by the ideologues. And I go up there, and, you know, I had somebody ask me, they said, well, John, how come you're not a Freedom Caucus member? I said, because I don't believe in their tactics. I said, look, when I was sheriff, it wasn't enough for me to stand up before the public and say, I don't like crime, like these ideologues do. No, I got to go out and I got to do something about it. I got to get something done. I have to be a pragmatist. You got to move the ball down the field. To use a football analogy, these ideologues want to throw a Hail Mary pass on every play. If they don't get 100% of what they want, they won't vote for that bill. Even though it may have come through a Republican-controlled committee where their amendment was voted down, they're like, without my amendment on there, I'm not voting for the bill. That's what these ideologues do. I told somebody in St. John's County, they asked me, what can we do to help you in D.C.? I said, never send another ideologue to Washington. Send pragmatists. Some people that understand, as was stated somewhere, I'm quoting somebody that said, compromise is the oxygen of democracy. That's what we need in Washington, D.C., not these ideologues. So when I got up there, when we were in the majority, when I was part of the majority, I reached out across the aisle. I was telling someone earlier, every single bill I filed, I reached out across the aisle in the Committee of Jurisdiction to a minority member to be my primary co-sponsor. Not just a co-sponsor, but a primary, which means their name goes on that bill too. I share that with them. I was able to do that, I think with every single bill I filed. The most notable was the Stop School Violence Act of 2018. I reached out to Ted Deutch in January of 2018, asked Ted if he was on judiciary with me, asked him if he would get on this bill. He agreed after he looked at it. He said, John, it's a great bill. I love it. I'll get on there with you. This was something that I wanted to do when I got to D.C. was address the school violence. So Ted's my primary. 2 weeks after I filed that bill, January 30th, On February 14th, the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School shooting occurs in Parkland, Florida, right in the middle of Ted Deutch's district. That was almost providential, I think. So there are some things that we can do to build bipartisanship in Washington, D.C., even though the entire system is designed to keep us apart. I go to a lunch. A lobbyist offers to take me to lunch, the Capitol Hill Club. I'm like, yeah, sure. We'll go pick up a sandwich. So we go to the Capitol Hill Club for lunch. When I get my menu, it says RCHC. So I'm like, damn, what's the R for? And he looked at me like I was crazy. He said, Republican. And I looked around the room. I said, Dan, are you telling me there's no Democrats in here? He said, no, John, their place is like four blocks that way. Here's the worst part. He thought nothing about it. I was aghast. We don't even eat together? Are you kidding me? So I'm looking for ways to build that bipartisanship that I know this group particularly understands and appreciates. That the institutions have to work. And the people in them have to work together. So I also became a member of a little-known group. And there are some great happenings in D.C. that you're never going to hear about because it's kind of boring if everybody's getting along. But I'm a member of the Bipartisan Working Group. Derek Kilmer, I'm sorry, Val's the actor. Derek Kilmer from Washington State is the Democrat co-chair, and Andy Barr from Kentucky is the Republican chair. And this bipartisan working group comes together regularly to work out legislation in a bipartisan way. Now, we only have 28 members, but it's growing. And I think as we have more pragmatists come to Washington, D.C. and get involved, we'll be able to get some things done. Now, let me tell you why it's important that that happen. And this goes to the situation that I'm here to talk about, the immigration and the security of our southern border. Folks, the reason we have the challenges that we have at our southern border is because of the rules that I just talked about. Because we can't get anything passed in Congress. So what's happened? The courts have stepped in. We created a void, the courts filled it. Now here's, and this is why I want you to know it's so important what you all do as the Federalist Society in pushing for and trying to educate people on the importance of following the Constitution. Interpreting the law as it is, not as they would like it to be. That's the importance of what you do in this group. Talking to colleges and high schools. The importance of following the Constitution. So what got us where we're at? Go back to 1985. The Jenny Flores Settlement Agreement. Jenny Flores was an unaccompanied minor at the border who had been taken into custody trying to cross, and she wasn't being released because they couldn't get her parents to come and pick her up because they were afraid that they were living in California. They were afraid that if they went to pick her up that they would be deported as well. So they sent some relatives, tried to pick her up. They wouldn't release her to anyone but a parent. So there were civil cases that were filed against the government under the name of Jenny Flores. The Flores Settlement Agreement that you've all heard about grew out of this challenge. The interesting thing is, it went through the courts. One court found for the ACLU, the other found for the government, and overturned the previous decision. So it went through several iterations, but finally wound up The government won. They won their case. But the Clinton administration, President Clinton, decided because of all these other cases that were still coming through the courts, because now they had latched on to something, they wanted to get rid of all these other civil suits. And so they decided to make this settlement on Jenny Flores. And basically what they said was, on these unaccompanied minors, they could only be held as long as necessary. They had to have conditions of, you know, they had to have decent conditions of confinement, and they could be released to parents, legal guardians, and they had an order, like parents, legal guardians, other family members, and anybody that the parents wanted them released to. But then in 2015, something changed that I think is the driving force behind the caravans that we see today. How many of you have seen the videos of people crossing the border with children in the pack? There'll be 100, you know, 100 or so people there. If you notice, they don't run from CBP. They don't run from Customs and Border Patrol. They run to them. Because they don't want to walk out of there. They want to be driven out of there. They want to be taken into custody because they know, under another court ruling by Judge Dolly G in California from the Middle District of California, she took the Flores settlement agreement under another case with a child who was accompanied by her mother and said, expanded the Flores settlement agreement to include not only unaccompanied minors, but accompanied minors. And she said, 20 days is the reasonable length of time that you can hold them before you either have to send them, either separate them or do what became known as catch and release and let them into the interior of the country together. That's when all the traffickers figured out that if we match children with individuals trying to cross the border and claim asylum, they get released into the interior of the country within 20 days. That's their maximum detention. Well, they get released on the 21st day. They get released into the country. And that's why you see these caravans now with all of these children involved coming to our border. And we can't stop them. In Congress, because of the 60-vote cloture rule and the ideologues haven't taken over, we can't get anything done. That's why I started with that. So when we were in the majority in 2017, the Republicans said, how many of you heard of the Goodlatte 2 bill? Goodlatte 2 was a bill that came out of Judiciary. It was named after Bob Goodlatte in Judiciary. Him and actually a couple others worked on it, but they came out with this bill, and it was going to secure the border. $25 billion was going to be set aside to secure the border. Now, what does border security look like? It's a lot of things, folks. It's a multi-layered approach. That, and, you know, as a sheriff, I've worked on a lot of security plans. I understand any good security plan is a multi-layered process. So the first step in that process is creating an impediment so that those who are coming in illegally can be detected. Detected in a manner, so you have to have that surveillance equipment so you can detect them. Then you need infrastructure so you can drive to where they're at to capture them. Folks, there's a lot of this area that is so remote, there are no roads. You can't drive. You have to go on horseback. So $25 billion to create the impediment, the wall, if you will, all the surveillance that was necessary, all the infrastructure that was necessary, and 5,000 additional CBP officers. In return, the minority was going to get, initially it started out at $1.2 million, DACA and Dreamers were going to be given LPR, legal permanent residency. As soon as that $25 billion was in the lockbox, as soon as that $25 billion had been spent and the border was secure, those $1.2 billion, or million, which later, before it even went to the floor, became $1.8 million because the president wanted to bump up the number of DACA and Dreamers and some others. $1.8 million illegal children who are in this country by no fault of their own would go from LPR to green cards. And with their green cards, they would go to the end of the line, and they would, over about a 10-year period, they estimated, would take them to work their way to the front to get citizenship. Our own Freedom Caucus members said no. That's amnesty. I'm like, that's not amnesty. These guys, in the meantime, during that 10 to 13, 15-year period that they have LPR and green cards, if they get arrested, they're out of here. If they join MS-13, they're out of here. There were a lot of controls that were in place. This bill did away with chain migration, did away with the visa lottery, created a merit-based visa system, would bring in E-Verify. Everything that, and it was going to bump up the numbers on H-2Bs, which we desperately need. The ideologues would not vote for that bill. Our own majority could not carry that bill because of the ideologues. And so within a year, after everyone figured out that the Gibb decision had expanded, I'm sorry, the G decision had expanded Flores to accompanied children, then we had just this mass migration of people with children. Some having smuggled the child back across the line to come in with somebody else. Some of the separation that's taken place at the border, you know, where you have this family separation, some of it's because the father's a murderer or the mother, whoever's with them, they committed these heinous crimes. We can't leave a child with that individual. Now we're actually doing rapid DNA testing at the border. They're implementing that so that, because we know a lot of these kids do not belong to the individual that's with them. They're not a parent. They're somebody that the traffickers have hooked them up with. So those are some of the challenges that we face at the border. We've got to find a way, and that's why I'm hoping that the bipartisan working group that I'm on, I'm hoping that we're going to take on this issue. We're also taking on the infrastructure. I have a little more hope for the infrastructure than I do for immigration, but we got to give it a good try and pull in more people who understand we have to fix this problem. It is a humanitarian crisis at the border. Now, look, I am incredibly supportive of immigration because I know the demographics of our country. Folks, to maintain our population, you have to have 2.5% birth rate. 2.5. We're at 1.99. We are going down without immigration. We're already at 3.6 or 3.8 unemployment now. We can't. That's why we have to have immigration. But we have to have legal immigration in an orderly way. We have to know who's coming in here. They have to be vetted properly. We can't just have people running across the border claiming asylum and then being released into the country and like 3%, 3.5% ever come back. That's got to be fixed. So I'm hoping that Congress can respond. I know the administration is trying to do all that they can do to mitigate this problem by having folks, instead of releasing them into the interior of America, keep them in Mexico. There's a lot of different ways to address this issue, but that's one of the important ones. And folks, that's why issues like Brett Kavanaugh being placed on the Supreme Court is so critically important to this country. That we have judges in these seats who understand that it is their job to enforce the law as it's written, not to enforce it the way they would like to see it written. So, you know, as just a side note, too, and one of the things I've tried to do on this issue of immigration, folks, we have E-2 visa people. These are folks who pay a lot of money, up to $500,000, to come into America to start a business. The problem is when their children are 18 years old, they get deported. That child may have been born here. This is the only country they know. And we're going to send them home. They've been schooled here. They've been raised here. And we're going to force them to leave this country, the only country that they've ever known, for many of them. The individual that owns that E-2 visa that came here to build a business, they have to $500,000 to start this business, and they have to hire American workers. Every 5 years, they get reviewed for deportation. Who can run a business that way? I was just made aware of this like 3 years ago when I first got into office. I had a lady come to my office, and she's got a great business, but her child is about to be deported. There is no pathway to citizenship for an E-2 visa dependent. I'm sure it's just an oversight. But these kids, and there are a lot of them. I think it was 180,000 or something like that. 180,000 of them. And they're all facing deportation at 18 years old. So those are some of the things that we have to fix, and we have to fix it in a bipartisan way. This stuff of just standing up and espousing some ideology is not enough. We got to move the ball down the field. That means I don't get everything I want, they don't get everything they want, but we make it better for everybody involved. That's what America needs, and that's what America deserves. And so I thank you for the opportunity to be up there representing Northeast Florida, trying to tackle some of these incredibly difficult issues that if we simply came together in a bipartisan way, we can move that ball down the field. I believe that. So thank you all very much, and I'd like to throw it open for some questions. We got about 15 minutes. Anybody? Ron?
I think, Congressman, you mentioned the connection between the Pulse nightclub shooting and immigration. And I didn't catch that. Was he an illegal immigrant?
No, but his father was allowed to immigrate to America from Afghanistan. If you go look, his dad was not a good guy. And clearly, he passed that ideology on to his son. And he killed 49 Floridians less than 4 hours from where all my grandchildren sleep. I'm not okay with that. What else? Y'all got to have some questions. Jay?
Your comments are excellent. Thank you. My father gives your sometimes tennis and breakfast partner gives his regards.
Yes, thank you.
I love the plea for bipartisanship. We know that's a bit of an elusive concept.
Can you give a brief, a little bit of color on what it was like to go from entering Congress in the majority, and now you serve the minority, what the lifestyle difference is, what it really is like now, the contrast?
Yeah, great question, Jay, because it is a stark contrast. Now, I will tell you, and I really didn't do it for this reason, because I really didn't expect that we would be out of the majority, but I created, through my bill process and some of the other things that I've done, I've created some great relationships across the aisle. And we've worked together on legislation. And so it's been less stark for me, and less stark also because I'm an appropriator. You know, I was incredibly blessed as a freshman, actually, halfway through the session, when Charlie Dent left, because of some work that I had done for the leadership, and because our, you know, when the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting occurred, everybody looked at the Congress and Speaker Ryan, you know, what are you going to do about this? And thankfully he was able to say, well, I've got this bill. You know, it had just been dropped 2 weeks ago. That bill passed and was signed into law in, I think, record time. So as a result of that, when Charlie Dent left the probes early, and I had made it known even before I got to Congress that I wanted to be on appropriations because it's an important committee for this district, I got that call from Paul Ryan. And so I was placed on probes. So that actually has blunted some of the hit from going from the majority to the minority, because you will also hear in D.C. you have Republicans, you have Democrats, and then you have appropriators, because appropriators still understand you got to work together. And so it's not been as bad for me as it could have been, because I do have those great relationships across the aisle. And so I'm still, I think, particularly through the bipartisan working group, can still be effective even though we're in the minority. And there's another saying that I've learned up there, that when you're in the majority, you legislate. When you're in the minority, you communicate. So we're doing a lot of communication, but we're also able to do a little legislating. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
What have you found to be the most successful way to identify the priorities of the quieter majority of your constituents?
Yeah, I will tell you, I think the best way to address the ideologue issue, and y'all hear me out on this, but folks, I think we need to bring back earmarks. Now, we need to call it something else because they have been so demonized. But think about this. That is an Article 1, and nobody understands this better than you guys. That's an Article 1 responsibility of the House. Not the Senate, the House. All appropriation bills originate in the House. And we should be deciding and determining where that money goes. Right now, we pass those 12 appropriation bills, it goes to the executive branch, and they decide how to spend it. That's atrocious. At least on that 1.5% of the budget that is discretionary, we should be able to go and argue for our district, for other districts, that we need things done. And we set the priority. Not some bureaucrat that no one has ever voted for, doesn't know who they are, but they're making these very telling decisions. That's how I think we bring the ideologues back. I had this conversation with Paul Ryan. You may remember the first health care vote he pulled off the floor. Remember that? In February of 17. Pulled that bill off the floor. I went to him because I'm aghast. And I said, Paul, what the heck is going on? Well, I said, Mr. Speaker, But I said, what is going on? I said, I don't get this. I said, look, when I was sheriff, I tell my men and women, take that hill. They would take that hill. In fact, Mr. Speaker, they would take a bullet to take that hill. I said, but I come up here and you say take the hill. And my own colleagues in our Republican conference are like, no, this is my Freedom Caucus hill over here. No, this is my Main Street hill over here. No, this is my Tuesday morning hill over here. I'm like, I don't get this. You know what he told me? He said, John, I tell people being speaker right now is like walking through a graveyard. I'm above a lot of people, but none of them down there are listening to me. And so that is a way, that district-driven funding with total transparency is the way that we can bring those people to bear. And leadership can have some control on the floor. Because right now, nobody's listening. We have time for a couple more? One more? Yes, sir.
Question on the national tax. Now, we all in this room understand that very few people want to talk about the size of the debt and the consequences that will flow from it. But privately, when you talk to your colleagues up there on the Hill, you've got $22 billion in debt. When interest rates get back to 5%, and they will, we'll be spending more on interest every year than we spend on any other national defense, Medicare, any other discretionary spend. We will be looking at a huge problem. What do people say privately about this?
Two things that I think everyone up there realizes. Number one, we can't continue to go down this road. Now, I was a guy that voted for that $1.2 trillion deficit. But let me tell you why. And this is important. Because the numbers aren't always what the numbers are. And here's what I mean. So part of the problem that we had was our military had been so underfunded for so long. Folks, we had 89 military members die in training the previous year to that vote. 89. We had 22 die in combat. Four times as many dying in training because we got ships running into each other because they can never go sailing. We got planes falling out of the air because they don't have a perfect supply line. 89 members. So I tell people, look, that $1.2 million deficit, that is termites in my house, and I have to address that. But fact of the matter is, in 2017, 2018, we had a fire in the kitchen. And that was our military. We had to plus that up. Now, that's not the only reason I was able to vote for it. I also didn't buy it. You know, the CBO scores this, and the CBO gives you these numbers. And they're guesstimating. They're trying to prophesy what the numbers are going to be. And in that bill, in that Tax Cut Jobs Act, they prophesied that the GDP would grow at 1.9% for the next 10 years. 1.9, where are we at? 3.2? Here's the important thing. Every percentage point above that 1.9, and I never bought that it was going to be 1.9. Because we hadn't done any of those things, the regulatory piece, the tax cuts, we hadn't done any of that in the previous administration, and they were running 1.5. So to think that we were only going to get 0.4 growth, I thought was ludicrous. It turns out I was right. It's more like 3%, 3.2%. And for every percentage point above 1.9, folks, that's an extra $274 billion in revenue going to the government. So in 3-4 years, that $1.2 trillion is covered. But we also know we're not going to cut our way to greatness. We've got to look at some of these mandatory spending programs like Social Security. Folks, I will tell you, at some point, we got to change the age. We have to face the fact that we're living longer. We're living much longer. I'm not a tax and spend guy. But I do understand that we have people living well into their 80s and 90s now. We have to address that. Now, you don't change it for the guy that's 50, 55, 60 years old. You change it for the 20-year-old who's got time to plan for it and understands that it's going to be 68 or 69 years old before they can retire. And so we have to look at those programs, and we also have to better manage our money. But there's no better way to get out of this than growing the economy and cutting mandatory spending. Look, discretionary spending is a small part of the budget. And folks, we got to realize that. So, again, let me, very quickly.
Why don't they put the money back that they borrowed out of for Social Security?
Well, it's they do every year. That's how they pay their bill. They pay that Social Security bill, but they pay it with printed dollars. That's the problem.
The thing is, there's a lot of immigrants in that they have on Social Security too.
Well, that's another reason we have to get a handle on this thing and make these people legal, paying taxes, working in the system. We need that labor.
But how can you give them the Social Security and Medicaid?
Well, they don't unless they have some type of legal permanent residency. They don't. Unless they're TPS or LPR, they don't. They're not supposed to. Now, they may get false documents and do all that. That's fraud. Yeah. And a lot of that does go on.
Is anybody checking that?
Well, not enough, I can tell you. But listen, it is truly... I am blessed with another calling in my life, and I want to thank all of you for having given me that opportunity to be up there serving this community and this country. It is a tremendous honor, and I thank you for that. God bless you all.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/Article I. That's fedsoc.org/Article I.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.